My heart has no words. My eyes have no tears left. Mind had done gone crazy. Went off and married my fears. Now I'm standing here with nothing left to tell you. I'm standing here with nothing to prove. I got nothing.
Welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. This is Heather, and today I am interviewing Jessica and Aaron, who are listeners of Mormon Expression from Logan, who reached out to me to be on the podcast. Hello, guys.
Hi.
How's it going?
So why don't we go ahead and jump right in and start talking about your childhoods within Mormonism. You're both members from birth, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Yes.
Who wants to go first?
Apparently I do. Okay. Well, I had a great childhood, first of all. My parents were wonderful people, kind and stable. So, yeah, great childhood. As far as being raised in Mormonism, maybe this is unique, maybe not. I don't know how unique, but very fundamental Mormonism, like McConkie-esque. Mormonism.
Can you give me some examples of how that played into your childhood?
Yeah. For instance, very specific gender roles within my home.
Okay.
So not so much that the girls weren't allowed to do yard work or the boys housework, because my mom was certainly not above making us all or requesting us all to assist her in the housework. But it was very clear what our roles and futures would be.
Okay.
So, and it was very clear what my parents' roles were. My father was the provider and the spiritual guide. Mm-hmm. My mother was the one in charge of our day-to-day physical well-being.
Did you have to ask your father if you could go do things with your friends, or was your mom allowed to answer those questions?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, sometimes they would refer us to one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
I think it mostly depended on who knew what was going on at the time. It wasn't so much gender there. I think that, yeah.
I had a friend who she had to ask her father to do anything.
Wow.
She had to call him at work.
Yeah, not like that rigid. Not that rigid.
Okay.
But still very clear-cut lines. Like, I really shudder to think what could have happened if any of us had turned out to be homosexual. Because that would have been a nightmare. For my parents, they have no skills of how to deal with that.
So, how did you feel about that environment and the church as a kid?
I didn't know anything different. It was just how it was. And as far as I knew I was different, being raised differently than my classmates, because I wasn't raised in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised in mostly in the state of Washington, not in Seattle area where it's a lot more liberal, but over by Idaho where it's a little bit. It's not quite Mormon corridor, but it's kind of on the edge. So, but even then, I knew I was being raised differently than a lot of my classmates. But at the same time, my classmates weren't my social sphere. My ward was. School was kind of like the business end of my life, but my social and my culture was within my ward. It didn't seem strange. It was just kind of how it was.
How about your teenage years? Did you start chafing against any of the doctrines as a teenager in the Alliance program?
I was never rebellious in any way, shape, or form. I think my leaving the church has confused my parents as much as it's hurt them, because I think of any of their children, they didn't think I would be the one to leave.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the eldest, yeah.
Okay.
And so I was always really responsible from a
mm-hmm.
young age.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't raise my siblings, but I assisted.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say I didn't fight against the teachings of the Young Women's Program. What they did do is aggravate an innate perfectionism.
You never felt like you were
good enough. Never felt like I was good enough. And there was a lot of pressure
mm-hmm.
to become better
mm-hmm.
within the church and within my home. It was always get an education, the best that you can, not in my case to get it, have a career. No. That was for the boys, right? They were told, bachelor's degree is not going to be good enough. You're going to need to go further than that. You're going to be providing for your family. I mean,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a lot of pressure to put on like a 12-year-old boy. For me, it was more get an education so that you can contribute to your family and be equal to your husband. In other words, don't be barefoot and pregnant, just be pregnant. Okay? Be a wife and a mother, but don't be ignorant. Mm-hmm. So that was, I guess that's like a step forward, right?
Yeah.
It could have been worse.
Mormonism.
I think Young Women's left me very depressed and under a lot of pressure. Okay. A very poor self-image. I mean, because you're taught with everything from modesty to what your role in life is going to be, you're taught to be, I guess, inferior. That you are not just inferior to men, but that you are innately flawed.
Right, and you're supposed to be humble and sweet and nice and nurturing
all the time. And so every little failure from raising your voice to not being able to sew, which, by the way, I can't, and hate, was a failure. And it wasn't just like, it's not just a, oh, I'm not really good at that. It's a failure. You failed. And that's a huge burden to carry around. And so I especially saw it flower during the first couple years of my marriage. Because I guess before that it was always, don't worry, you don't have to perform quite yet. You're not failing quite yet. But in the first couple years of my marriage, I was like, I'm not anywhere near the perfect wife. I really beat myself up. So I think that's mostly what Young Women's did as far as the teachings go.
Those struggles or the problems that it gave you, it never led you to doubt anything?
Very little. One of the only issues within the church that I struggled with was polygamy. And not to say I knew much about it. I knew that it had been a part of the early years of the church, but I didn't know really specifics. I had no idea that Joseph Smith had been a part of that. I knew that it had been a part of the early years of the church, and by the time I went on my mission, I had kind of talked myself into believing the whole it was needful at the time or something, but
So many men died on the plains.
There was too many women. It made me uncomfortable for a very long time. Like the idea of my father having more than one wife or me having to be an extra wife. That was, especially when you're in Young Women, you're being given the rhetoric of Snow White and Prince Charming.
Yeah.
And you're like, wait a minute, there's lots of princesses for one prince. Wait a minute, that's
right.
Not sitting quite right.
All right, so how about you, Aaron? Why don't you tell me about what it was like for you to grow up in the church?
I'm completely opposite from Jessica. I'm number 9 of 10 children, so I have a big family. My parents are about 20 years older than hers.
Okay.
And so kind of different generations. Mm-hmm. And by the time I came around, my parents had kind of lightened up, I guess you could say, on, I think they just learned what not to do with the first 8 kids or so. Six kids, and then there's an 8-year gap. And so the church was important. We went to church, but we didn't have family home evening all the time because we were busy. My sister was in dancing. I and my brothers were playing soccer. So the church was there, but it wasn't as fundamental as Jessica. For me, I loved it. I soaked it up just like everybody else did probably when they were little. I loved the idea of being with my family. I loved the idea of having priesthood and things like that. I played soccer a lot, so I wasn't really involved in Boy Scouts. Cub Scouts, you know, I went through just fine, but that was really hard because in Mormonism, Boy Scouts and church are like best friends. And so when I would skip out on Scouts, I'd come to church and be guilted. You know, why weren't you at Scouts? Blah, blah, blah. And I was just like, I've been playing soccer. I'm busy, you know, I don't have time for this. And I didn't like it, so that was kind of difficult. But other than that, we were expected to go on missions and do everything else. But my parents, they didn't strangle us because they knew if they did that we would resist. So they were pretty good. And it was a great childhood. I loved it. It was great being raised in the church for those 20 years or so. And then after that, I didn't like it so much.
So basically, your family and you fit the Mormon mold, and it wasn't taken so seriously. And so it didn't cause a lot of stress in your youth.
No, not too much. I mean, they had 10 kids, so we did fit the Mormon mold. And my second oldest brother, he left the church and moved out when he was 18 or 19. Mm-hmm. You know, and they let that happen, and so they obviously realized that you can't force your children to do things. And so I was very thankful for that.
So, how about pressure to go on a mission? Did you Were you gung-ho to go on a mission, or did you feel that pressure and chafe against it?
A little bit. All of my brothers, except the one that moved out, they had gone on missions. When I was 19, I was still wearing braces and undergoing hormone therapy, so I had medical issues that I couldn't really go.
Mm-hmm.
And I would get really upset when people would be like, so, are you going on a mission? And I'd say no, and they would just be like, oh, and not talk to me about it, or and things like that. And so that pressure kind of pushed me away even more. And so I didn't go when I was 19. I stayed home and I worked, and I started to rebel from the church. And that way I could say, well, I'm not going on a mission because I don't even believe it.
So do you think that you rebelled because of the stigma of not going on a mission when you're, quote, supposed to?
Yes, in part. And I was kind of mad that God gave me these bodily issues, I guess you could say. I just, I didn't have any growth hormone in my body. And so I was like 5'8" when I graduated high school, 110.
So you started to rebel.
Mm-hmm.
And how far down the path of not going on a mission did you go?
Let's see. So 19 and 20, I started drinking and just not going to church. I didn't believe it. I moved out for a little while. And then I moved back home. And after that, I still rebelled for a while. And it was really a dark time because I was drinking alcohol and I hated myself and my bodily image. And I felt like a failure because I wasn't going to school and I didn't go on a mission. And it was just not a good time. And I started dating girls. I really like girls. And had a serious girlfriend when I was 22-ish. I didn't go on a mission until I was 23. We broke up, and then I got engaged to another girl. We broke up again, and then I was ready spiritually, I guess, to go on a mission. I felt like that's what I needed to do.
So you'd kind of gone through this rough time, and you thought, I need to get my act together. Mm-hmm. And you had grown up with a paradigm that if you start going to church and doing the right thing, then you'll start feeling better. So you kind of put yourself on that path.
And I did. I started going to church, and I was able to get self-esteem again and felt like I should go on a mission because I wanted to help people that had been through what I had been through and wanted to help them find the happiness.
All right. So, Jessica, you also went on a mission, correct?
I did.
Okay. And did you go to college for a little while before you went on a mission?
I did. I went to 2.5 years of university. And for me, it wasn't an earth-shaking decision, really. I just decided I wanted to go. I felt good about it. It did stud me a little bit that I'd actually committed. It wasn't because I couldn't get married. but it was just kind of, well, I'm 21, and I'm feeling very burnt out from school. Been doing this for a lot of years now. And I was like, I really want something different, and I have this option. Sounds good.
So where did you go to school?
At Utah State University.
Okay. And I'm unfamiliar with Utah State University. I know that there's a rivalry with BYU, but is the culture Mormon as well, even though?
Hugely.
Okay.
It's not, obviously Utah State isn't run by the church, and so it does not have the same rules and standards. But the Mormon influence is very, very big there. There's actually 8 student stakes.
8 stakes, not wards.
Not wards, stakes.
Wow.
There's
okay.
several hundred wards of students there. There's an enormous institute building with a celebrated institute choir. The Mormon influence is very strong there, although it actually is kept separate from the academia side of things.
Right, because it's not run by the church.
It's not run by the church. So the school itself, although it hires and teaches LDS people, it itself is much more academic, I should say.
All right, so I have a question I want to ask you, and I'm afraid it's going to come off odd.
Okay.
Did you receive any pressure or signs of disapproval from people that you were going on a mission? Because you're pretty, and you're smart, and you're friendly. So were you receiving pressure from people? Why are you going on a mission? You should be getting married. That kind of stuff?
Only from one guy, and that's because he wanted to marry me. after one date. Scary! but other than that, everyone was very supportive. My friends, my family, and people that just would find out. We're just like, oh, cool.
Okay.
So, no, I didn't get a lot of cultural blowback for that one. That was, yeah.
So, let's go back to Aaron. Tell me where you went on your mission and what it was like.
I went on my mission to San Diego, and like I said, I turned 24 within my first month of being there, so I was older.
He wrote to me that some of those 19-year-olds just drove him up the wall.
But,
and they might have been your senior companions.
Yeah. But it was interesting because during that time I was preparing for my mission, even before I was decided I really want to go, my little brother, because he was 19, he was called to a mission, and he went to the MTC, and he had life-threatening asthma, so they sent him home. Mm-hmm. And the mission he was called to was San Diego. Mm-hmm. And so a year or so later, when I get my call and open it, everyone was like, oh, they must need a bowman out there in San Diego or something. And it was one of those, you know...
Confirmation bias.
Yes. And so you asked, how was my mission? Mm-hmm. Or it was good. I got out there, and of course I had this fear in the back of my mind that maybe I wasn't really forgiven for my sins, you know, maybe because I messed up that I wasn't going to be a good missionary. And so the first area, it was fine. I became a senior companion within 2 or 3 months, and I was training 2 kids at once, and we weren't getting baptisms, and President Hinckley was alive at this time. Mm-hmm. And my mission president took the challenge to double convert baptisms very seriously. And so he challenged us to baptize every week. And it wasn't happening for us. And so what do good Mormons do? They blame themselves. And so I was like, okay, maybe I'm not really forgiven. And I pretty much just like shut down. And I didn't have any confidence in myself. And then during this time, he transfers me to a new area. And I'm going to be district leader. And I'm going to have a new companion. And he's Tongan and doesn't speak a lot of English. And I'm dealing with this inner turmoil. And it just wasn't good. And so after a week or so, the mission president sent me to a psychiatrist, and she put me on antidepressants. And I wanted to go home, but he sounded so hurt when I told him I wanted to go home that I didn't, and I stuck it out.
So something I haven't really asked you all this way through so far is if you have had any doubts up to that point in your life.
Oh, yes. During my rebellious times, one of my friends is like, did you know Joseph Smith was a Mason and he married a 14-year-old girl? And I was like, what? And it just made me so upset. And then a little while later, my friend's sister told me, because she was married in the temple and then she became disaffected. And she's like, yeah, in the temple, it's just secret handshakes. And I was like, you're kidding me. I was like, that's what the temple is about, is...
It's a boys' club.
I know. It gave me more reason. I was like, okay, this is so weird. And so after I had my little conversion experience where I decided to get ready to go on a mission, mm-hmm. I really wanted to proclaim the truth, and I was on message boards already, like video game message boards, mm-hmm. and sometimes they'd have spirituality sections, and I'd go in there and defend Mormonism, and, mm-hmm. and I wasn't very good at it, so I would go search... I found FAIR and the old MAD boards, because okay. those are apologetics and they knew their stuff. And so I was aware of some of the issues, but it wouldn't stick. Mm-hmm. Right. Because I was like, oh, these guys can explain it. So
it doesn't matter.
Right. But I was aware of a lot of the issues before I went on my mission.
Okay. And when you were on your mission, did you struggle with any of those issues when you were feeling down and out?
Not really. Just a few. Like I was surprised that the Holy Ghost wasn't converting people like we were taught mm-hmm. it would. And just little instances where one day I was studying the Book of Mormon, and it was the when Jesus is visiting the Nephites, and I compared it to the Sermon on the Mount. Mm-hmm. And there was the JST translation wasn't in the Book of Mormon. And I remember as a missionary thinking, if the Book of Mormon is the pure trend, why wasn't, you know, I was yeah. that conundrum, and I just remember thinking, what in the heck? Oh, well, on the shelf. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. If I had any issues, I would just put it on the shelf. We taught a lady that had a big problem with polygamy, mm-hmm. and I was like, I don't know. I just know that Joseph Smith's a prophet, so whatever.
That was your answer yep. to her? Did she join?
No, she didn't. And I was such an idiot. Here I am, this 25-year-old kid, and her husband had cheated on her, and I'm trying to tell her, that, no, polygamy's fine. We don't do that anymore. You should just, you know. I was just, oh my word.
You
I'm so embarrassed.
Cute.
I know. I thought I had the answers. And
that cocky youth assured thing.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so how about you, Jessica? How was your mission?
Well, I was called to Albuquerque, New Mexico, which I was fine as long as it wasn't in Africa. The idea of going to, like, a third world country, especially one that's, like, as disease-ridden as Africa, scared me so much. Mm-hmm. So I was like, stateside, sweet, I can do that. And I was English-speaking even, so I was like, even better. I really enjoyed my mission. I hated the MTC. I especially resented fasting at the MTC because I felt like it was very forced. Because
so how, explain when you fasted and why.
Fasting at the MTC is very, you can't get around it because the cafeteria simply does not make food. And nobody in your class and nobody other classes line up to go get food.
So is it just the first Sunday of the month?
It's the first Sunday of the month, but it's a full fast.
Did they also turn off vending machines?
Yes.
Okay.
So no free agency.
Yeah.
No free agency. There's no free agency at the MTC.
No Jesus's plan.
No. No.
Okay.
I really struggled against the rigidity of the MTC. My parents will be the first to tell you, don't tell me what to do. Mm-hmm. I don't like it.
I can tell you. Don't tell her what to do.
My mother got really good at requesting things from me because if she ordered, I would tell her flat out no. And so the MTC chafed a lot. Mm-hmm. My mission, even though I had a very strict mission president, well, he's not around, right?
Mm-hmm. He's not constantly
overseeing me. So as strict as he was, I didn't feel quite so hedged in. I did chafe against a lot of the mission rules, and even wrote of my struggles about that to my family and was just kind of urged to do my best. I think they had the intelligence not to tell me to try to be perfect. But other than that, I really enjoyed my mission. Most of my companions were really fun and great. I met some of the funniest people and great people. The fact that I even had a couple of baptisms totally thrilled me. Because I kind of went in expecting to not. Because I was going stateside. I figured, you know, people around here kind of know Mormonism a little. It's like a state away from Utah.
Yeah.
I mean.
You did get homesick, though.
I got very, very homesick.
And you wanted to go home at the end, but that's a spoiler.
I did get very homesick, and my poor mission president had no idea how to deal with it. I think I was the only one experiencing that level of homesickness, and so he was kind of like,
Was it homesick for Logan, or homesick for home?
Home. I wanted my family, but not just my family, I wanted life again. I was homesick for books. Oh, man, because I am a voracious reader. Mm-hmm. And the only things I could read were the standard works and anything by Talmadge, basically. And that, oh, man, that was hard. Was really hard.
I read Jesus the Christ, like, 4 times.
I know. Because there's time, especially when any of you or your companions had any kind of health issues, from a cold to anything more serious, and you're stuck in your apartment.
With nothing to read and nothing to watch.
Nothing to read, nothing to watch, nothing to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like mind-numbingly dull those days. So
do you think that, this is a question I've never thought to ask before, do you think they do that? You can't watch TV, you can't listen to music, you can't read anything to make living in your apartment so boring that you want to be out unless you absolutely have to be?
I suppose that could be part of it. That's think it's mostly because they're trying to keep you very, very, very focused.
Yeah.
Which they do a very good job of. Mm-hmm. When you are just living and breathing the gospel every minute of every day, you don't think about anything else. You don't have a chance to think about anything else.
Not even the Army does that, though.
I know, not even the Army's that rigid.
And I'm pretty sure they're dedicated, you know? They can at least call home every now and then.
Yeah. I enjoyed my mission. There were some days where I was like, this is never going to end. Mm-hmm. I am going to be... I'm in hell. Like, this is never going away. I'm stuck. And I did get pretty trunky by the end, but that's because of Aaron.
Shh. You don't know that yet.
Spoilers! So, but I enjoyed my mission. I liked it.
I guess I didn't talk about getting sent home. Or is that coming later?
Oh, I guess not. I guess I immediately switched over to Utah.
Yeah, sorry.
I served the full 18 months of a girl's mission, but Aaron did not do 2 years. But it wasn't his fault.
What happened?
So I got transferred. I was transferred again, and this was just about the year mark. And I was in a new area.
Just over.
Just over the year mark. I was in a new area, new companion, Tongan.
The guy that couldn't speak English.
No, the new guy.
Different Tongan.
I knew him from the MTC a little bit. Okay. And I'm there for about a week, and the mission president, and I'm still just like, I'm not sure how I'm going to handle this, because it's a new area, I don't know anything, and I'm the senior companion again, because I asked to be moved down to junior during my struggle time, and the mission president's like, okay, this preparation day, no games, nothing, stay home and clean your apartments. Some of them, I went in and there was literally
elders are gross.
3 feet of garbage in the corner.
And, well, they're 19-year-old boys.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, I was always...
fraternity at a college, that's what you're going to get.
I was always the missionary that was cleaning the toilets and dishes and stuff like that. So
yeah, he actually helps me around the house a lot. It's nice.
Spoilers. Anyway, so... We go, okay, we're going to gather to get the mail, and we gather to get the mail, and we're not supposed to play, so I'm doing what I usually do, which is go into the library and read old end signs and stuff. You know, I really like to do that. And they're playing soccer, and I was sitting there thinking, and I was like, you know, I really miss playing soccer. I'm going to go in there and show them a thing or two. Well, within 5 minutes, my companion kicked me from behind and dislocated my kneecap, and it hurt like crap. And so... I was like, I'm okay. And they picked me up and put me on the stage. And then one of them ran to the freezer and grabbed the sacrament bread and brought it out and put it on my leg. And I went to the ER later, much, much later, after an appointment that we had set. I limped to it.
Totally, boys. Like, I hear this and I'm thinking.
Well, I was a missionary. You're supposed to work through it. And we went to the ER and they found out within a week that I had dislocated my kneecap and I'd have to be sent home for surgery. And... when they said that you might be sent home, I was ready to go home. I was like, I want to see my cats. I miss my cats.
So had they given you the option of going back?
No.
No.
No, I mean, there wasn't an option to stay. It was, you have to go home for surgery.
Right. Well, I had a friend who had to come home for knee surgery on both of his knees.
Oh, wow.
And they released him. He went home and had his surgeries. And 6 months later, after the surgery, he went back.
Yes, that I was my mission president. He told me at the beginning of his own conference that I'd be going home the next day or so. And he told me, you know, we want you to come back. No dating, stay away from girls, just heal and then come back. And so that was the plan.
How would that have worked? Would that have been, you have to reapply? Or would you have just gone to talk to your state president and they would have
I think that's what it was. And then I think the time that I would have been home would have been added on at the end.
Right.
I'm not sure exactly. But so I was like, okay, I'm going to go home and I'm going to prepare. I'm going to study. I'm going to get ready. So when I come back, I'll be a kick-ass missionary.
So you had planned on going back?
Yeah.
Until you got home?
I got home and it was hell. As anyone can tell you that's been sent home for any reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're automatically put in the black.
Oh, of course.
In that black
I'm like,
column.
Yeah, everybody assumes that you were sexually promiscuous.
I'm like, look at my bloody knee. You know? And I just felt really guilty for being home and on my mission, at least I was moving forward with my life. Mm-hmm. And when I was home, I was just in limbo, just waiting, you know, therapy, pain pills, surgery, and waiting for the day to come when I can go back. And it was very tough emotionally. I wrote in my journal that I was like, I'm in hell right now. This is horrible. I want to go back. Mm-hmm. But that changed after a while.
After getting comfortable.
Getting comfortable. And I just didn't want to go back to it. I got back on the mad boards and things like that. Mm-hmm. And somebody mentioned Joseph Smith translating with a hat, his face in a hat. Mm-hmm. And I just remember thinking, what? I was like, that can't be true. And
he sat right in front of the plates with the Urim and Thummim, right?
He was tracing his finger along on the etchings and just things like that. And I started thinking more about polygamy. And I was just like, you know, it's not worth going back to talk about Joseph Smith and just be miserable. But again, I don't think I can do it. Mm-hmm. But even then, like, the next day, I'd be like, I'm going back. And Jessica was coming home soon, but...
So you're going home kind of coincided with when the end of your mission was going to be.
3 months.
Early. No, two.
Two, whatever.
Two. Okay, so that really was motivation to not go back then.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so we kind of skipped over something since I went straight to your mission.
Yes.
Yeah, we kind of need to go backtrack.
So let's talk about the temple and what... happened at the temple outside of just being at the temple.
Yeah.
And go ahead and you guys tell me all about that.
Okay, so how we met or mm-hmm. our temple? Oh, just okay.
The whole thing.
How you met, what I okay. think there was a reason you met at the temple, and your experience, all of that.
We didn't, well, there was not really a reason. It was just kind of coincidence. We had both scheduled for the same session. We didn't know each other.
Okay.
And we had scheduled for the same session to receive our endowments for the first time and go through for the first time. So we just happened to be in the same session.
Okay, okay.
And be first timers. My experience with the temple was a lot of it I kind of let go over my head. And that was some advice.
You were overwhelmed.
I was totally overwhelmed. And that was some advice I received from a friend who told me, she's like, you're going to be completely overwhelmed. She's like, don't try to remember anything. Don't try to memorize anything. Just sit back and feel the spirit. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay. Which, by the way, terrified me more than any other advice I'd been given. I was like, what's going to happen?
Exactly. What kind of roller coaster is
exactly.
this?
Yeah. And, of course, nobody tells you anything at all. And, of course, I wasn't involved in any kind of apologetics, so I had no clue what was coming.
Had you taken a temple prep class?
No, I actually didn't do temple prep, mostly because my parents told me I wouldn't learn anything. Which, okay. they're right.
Right.
So, I'm at the temple, first time, and I have my garments, and they're on backwards. Because I didn't, nobody told you how to put mm-hmm. them on, right? Mm-hmm. I found it, of course, I'm sitting later on during the during the ceremony when they start to explain the veil. I was like, wait a minute.
I'm not seeing those marks. So, were your garments kind of just like the t-shirt-y type?
They were, but my mother, bless her, has everything she's ever bought for me is like 5 or 6 sizes too big. and these were no exception, so I felt very ugly.
Right.
Because I was wearing these hugely baggy garments and all these funky clothing, and I felt really ugly. And it occurred to me, and even though I had been building it up my whole life that one day I'd be wearing garments, and you know, they tell you in young women, you need to start dressing for it now so that you don't have to throw away all your clothes. Even then, it still hadn't really hit me until that very day when I put them on. It suddenly occurred to me, I'm like, I'm never going to be able to take these off again.
Right.
Oh my God.
Right, yeah.
And I almost had a panic attack right there because I felt very trapped and so ugly. My other, some other experience, I was a little bit frustrated that I didn't learn anything new.
That what you sat through is basically just the creation story.
Yeah, I was like, they taught us this in primary. I thought I was supposed to come here and learn all these new things. I remember thinking the secret handshake thing was just so weird. And I'm like, what is this, the boys only club? Are we 10? Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, I hated veiling my face. I felt very claustrophobic. Other than that, though, I didn't put a lot of symbolism into it. I do now. And then I remember, I actually felt really good making the covenants because I knew I was worthy. I was such a good girl.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't doing anything wrong. So I felt easy making the covenants and promises. That didn't give me undue stress. What bothered me was the one where you're promised to obey your husband.
Mm-hmm.
That really bothered me, really bothered me. Again, I don't like being told what to do. And I was like, and I was just like really afraid that I was somehow going to be duped into marrying a control freak. Don't worry, I didn't. But it scared me. I felt like I was having power taken from me, and that scared me. So that kind of bothered me. But other than that, I sort of let everything just kind of go over my head.
Okay.
Later on, other things began to make themselves evident as I went through more times,
mm-hmm.
Such as the fact that women don't have any direct access to God, mm-hmm. according to the temple. It always is through your husband.
Or a priesthood leader.
Or a priesthood leader of some kind. And that again, that really bothered me. Mm-hmm. And like the whole veil thing that mm-hmm. I can't show God my face. Well, what's wrong with my face?
Right.
I thought it was a human face.
Well, and it's not like he doesn't know what it looks like anyway.
Yeah, right? So he's supposed to be my father. And I felt like in many ways the temple was actually creating barriers mm-hmm. between me and God. Where before I had felt like I had a very close relationship with mm-hmm. God mm-hmm. and what I thought he was. But the temple seemed to be creating barriers, and that, again, that bothered me. And, like, I had to do, like, secret handshakes to get into heaven. Again, are we 8?
honey, the veil was so you could play peekaboo with God.
Mm-hmm. Peekaboo.
Well, the thing that occurs to me is that if all it takes to get into heaven is to know how to do a handshake, all it takes is one apostate telling the rest of the world how to do those handshakes, and the plan is just completely killed.
Hence
the penalties to scare people not to do it.
Well, but of course, the penalties weren't there when I went through, and so a lot of the symbol and other things weren't there when I went through, so a lot of the symbolism doesn't make sense at all. But again, that's stuff I've learned since then. So those are my temple impressions, and then we'll swing to Aaron.
Unlike Jessica, I took the temple prep class twice with two different girls. And they are just very, very simple. I remember she had like a wedding ring on the table, and she's like, "What is this? A wedding ring? What does it stand for? Marriage? It's a symbol of marriage. In temple, we learn symbols. It's symbolic, you know, just little things like that." And, of course, I'd known from apologetics and stuff about the handshakes and things like that, but I was really concerned that I was going to have to get naked at some point. I just knew I was going to have to. And thank goodness I went in 2005 at the end, so it was after the touching had been toned down a little bit. But I went through and I loved it because I finally felt like I was in the group. Mm-hmm. Because most Mormon kids, they go, males at least, they go when they're 18, 19. And here I was almost 24 and I was finally, you know, I was there with my brother and my mom and dad and, you know, I was on the right path. So
you
I was
felt like you were catching up.
Yeah. I was just like, yes. And so it was really good. And, one of the gentlemen in the temple presidency was my mom's cousin. And while I was in the waiting room with my dad, he came in and there's another gentleman and he's like, "Yeah, we got two missionaries, you and a girl missionary. And then this guy's getting sealed to his wife." And I was like, "Oh, that's cool." So they take us into the endowment room and we sit down and I look over and I see this girl and her smile just lit up the room and her eyes would get squinty when she smiled and she had long brown hair and she looked so hot. And I was like, "I'm checking out that guy's wife." I was like, "I can't be doing that in the temple." I was like, "This is so bad." And so throughout the whole session, you know, I would look over there and I was just so attracted to her. I just thought she was beautiful and it wasn't sexual in any way because, come on, the robes don't show anything.
And there's no way it could be sexual in those clothes.
but I really thought she was attractive and I thought that guy was lucky. Mm-hmm. And so we get through the session. I'm getting dressed by, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just standing there and my brother's like, "No, this goes here and this goes here." And we get to it's my turn to come up to the veil and I stand up and my bow had gotten caught and it ripped. And I was just like, "Oh," I was like, "I ripped my bow." And they didn't really care. So I get in the celestial room and
it's the only time as a guy you'll say you ripped your bow.
I know, my bow. I was like, and so we get in the celestial room and I was really happy. I just imagined my family coming to, you know, gathering after death. So it was really special. My mom brings over that guy's wife and he's like, "This is my son." And I was like, "Hi." And she said, "You guys should get together after your missions." I was like, "Mom, she's getting married." And she's like, "No, that she's not." And
the reason his mother felt comfortable approaching me is because with me in my party of supporters was a mutual acquaintance. She knew that she knew, and she approached him and asked about me because Aaron. No,
he asked why he was. She asked him
why he was there. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and so she approached me, and I just remember thinking she was an adorable old lady.
And you knew you recognized my little brother.
I had gone to high school with Aaron's little brother.
Oh, okay.
So
because I'm older, because I didn't go.
But I didn't really recognize him. I just remember looking and thinking, "I know that kid."
Right. Okay.
So yeah, and that was it. It was just like, "Hi," and we shook hands, and then she went over to her family, and I stayed with my little group.
Yeah, he didn't like hit on me.
No.
In the temple. It's totally
like that was it.
Right?
It was like a 5-second meeting.
It would have been like hitting elevated, though.
Exactly. Celestial hitting.
Celestial dating. Yeah. Right.
And it wasn't, you know, she went her way and I went my way. And
I completely forgot about him.
And I thought of her, you know, I was like,
"Oh." And he dubbed me Temple Girl.
Yeah, I was like, "I met
a girl." He didn't forget about me.
"I met a girl in the temple and yada, yada, yada." And about 3 or 4 weeks later, I was in the grocery store I work at and I look up and here she comes in with her mom. And I was like, "Oh man, I got to do this." So I creeped on her and tracked her down in the store and I was like, "Hey, do you remember me?" And She didn't, and we talked, and I was like, hey, can I write you unless you have a boyfriend? And she's like, I don't have a boyfriend. Why do you think I'm going on a mission? So, and then her mom's like, why don't you give him your phone number, and he can call you, and then you can exchange addresses.
Yeah,
so we did.
I didn't have my mission address.
Yeah, we did, and then we exchanged, and a week later, less than a week later, she went on her mission. And that was it. Like,
we didn't
had
date,
a date, nothing.
Nothing. We talked on the phone, then, because he called me that night, and we did talk, or I should say, I talked.
She talked so much.
And it somehow didn't chase him off, but, and we began to write. It took a while. He didn't write to me until he had also gone into the MTC, and by that time, I had been on my mission for a full transfer. Mm-hmm. And then I all of a sudden get a letter from him, and I got really excited, and I wrote him two letters in response, which he got at the same time, and then we just started.
She sent one to the wrong. We moved addresses.
Anyway,
so
it took a while.
Yeah, so yeah. We just wrote throughout our missions, just like get to know you questions, and this is my mission, and
this is my family. This has been my life.
Yeah, I was really afraid to tell her that I was put on antidepressants because you know that's. You don't need. Yeah,
and
you don't need that.
I was really afraid to tell you that I had irritable bowel syndrome. I was like, "Oh my gosh, she's gonna hate."
And
that.
Then I was like, "I have it too."
Wow, we're made for each other.
So, is that allowed?
Writing
to each other,
as long as you're not in the same mission, they're not going to be uncomfortable with it. I mean, because a lot of missionaries were writing to girls or boys at home.
Okay.
So, you know, it was just kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
We just happened to be both on missions. But we weren't in the same mission, and we were a couple states separated. So they weren't concerned.
We sent exchange pictures.
But not like naughty pictures. They're just like mission pictures.
It's okay, honey.
Yeah.
We can tell. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. It was like, hey, look at me holding this investigator's cat, and look at me tracking this house. And
we actually kind of had like a contest of animals going on who could take the most pictures of us with animals because we're both animal lovers. Mm-hmm. So,
okay.
But yeah, it was really innocent and just kind of a get to know you. But by the time I'd been on my mission for 14 months or so, I was in love with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that I was going to wait for him however long it took for him to finish. And I kind of figured it out. It was going to be like 9 months or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then he broke his knee and went and beat me home. And then I was kind of like,
I didn't know she liked me, really. I thought she kind of liked me, but
I was being very guarded because I was a missionary.
Mm-hmm.
So I got home and I met one of our mutual friends. I didn't know we were friends, like mutual friends. But anyway, she came over. She's like, oh, yeah, she likes you so much because she talked to her on the phone when she called. And I was like, score.
Okay, so you guys came home from your missions. Your brother went to high school with her, so you're also from Washington.
No.
I moved to Utah when I was 16 with my family.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
My father changed places of employment, basically. He works for Utah State.
Okay.
So.
Okay, so then you both came home to the Logan-ish area. And so you both went back to school, or went, just were in Logan and
started dating. Summertime. It was summertime.
It was like 3 days after she came home, I called her.
Mm-hmm. And we set up a date.
Well, my mission president wanted me to come out on my mission the day before she came home.
Mm-hmm. But your doctor vetoed.
And my doctor was like, are you kidding me? You're not healed. Mm-hmm. And my mission president was trying, he's like, we'll put you in a car, we'll do all this. And I was kind of upset that he would put my physical well-being at risk just to get me out there and to get numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, my knee is the rest of my life.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And I was like, my knee hurts when I walk. And that girl's coming home.
He still was using a crutch, just one, when I got home.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, knee injuries they take a long time to heal.
So you started dating.
Yep.
And was the relationship that you had in letters, did it translate into real life?
Oh, yeah. He's actually, I remember marveling at how natural it felt.
Mm-hmm.
And I had done very little dating and never had a boyfriend.
Okay.
I'd never kissed anybody. I'd never even held a man's hand. So I was very naive about any kind of physical relationship, but it just felt very natural and easy. I wasn't scared at all.
Okay.
I was just excited and happy.
So how long did you date before you got married?
6 months.
Okay.
And that includes engagement.
Okay. And temple wedding, I'm assuming?
Yeah, I didn't, because of my previous engagement.
Yeah.
I was really gun shy about getting a ring. And so I didn't officially propose with the ring until I did it in the temple, because we met in the temple, in the celestial room. And that's
cheesy
that's
for
what
you.
Do.
Did they let you get down on a knee?
No, because when we were dating and went to the temple together, she kind of kneeled at my feet to talk to me because I was praying. And within like
they
2 seconds,
bustled me right up.
A lady
I was like, what?
Was like, no, we don't kneel. Don't, you know, I was like, anyway, so no, I didn't do that. But that was October 30th and we got married December 20th, which was
the day we met exactly 2 years later
in the temple,
nice.
Same temple.
So, but we actually set that date before he officially proposed. So we'd already called and made the appointment.
Yeah,
like it was.
We're like 2 years to the day of when we met in the temple in the same place. And it was perfect Mormon wedding, you know.
It really was.
And
fairy tale.
And at our ceiling, when we told the mission or the temple president. Yeah, he's like, that's a first. We're putting this in the Logan Law history books or whatever, the Logan Temple history books.
Yeah.
And I don't have the heart to call him and tell him to update it. You know?
They've now left the church.
You might want to scratch us off that list.
Right. Okay, so I have here written down that you didn't particularly care for the wedding ceremony.
I hated my wedding.
And why was that?
Well, the reception was in a church gym. It felt cheap. It felt rushed. The wedding ceremony itself, the sealer, I mean, he's your mother's cousin.
Yeah. And
he reamed you.
He totally just ripped me to shreds in front of, like,
all of
Jessica's
our family.
Family, my family, friends. He's sitting, like, I'm sitting down and he's talking to me and he said...
So, okay, this is something I've wondered about. I know that the person who does your sealing... Like, it's the privilege of giving you advice or something like they do. You're not kneeling at that point.
No, you're sitting down waiting
like
it's
next
before
to,
the altar.
Next to, like, her family's and
so you're not
our
even
mother's.
Sitting together. You're
No, we're sitting together.
But her,
okay.
My mom's here and her... So okay. we're flanked by her family and he just starts going off. You need to be patient. You need to be good to her. Don't you get mad. It just ripping me up and down. And I was just looking around at everyone and everyone's smiling, you know. I was just like... Okay, don't hurt me, sort of thing.
I remember feeling really defensive for Aaron's sake, and I was like, lay off him! What are you doing?
Aren't you supposed to tell us to not go on a honeymoon and buy food storage instead?
Another thing that was irksome is that we weren't, and I think this was just him, I don't think this is a standard practice, but we weren't allowed to look at each other. During our sealing, he made us look at him.
While he read the prayer.
While he was reading everything.
Over the altar. He's like, now you look at me, not your sweet wife, while I read this prayer. And so I'm
looking at an old guy.
Doing a certain hand grip with my wife over the altar, looking at him, trying to feel emotion. I'm like, aren't I supposed to cry or feel happy that I'm getting married? And all I could think is, why can't I look at my wife?
So not only did you not get to say vows or express any feeling for one another... But you were even lost out on that whole, like, two-mirror thing.
Yeah, I think I glanced at her once or twice, but I felt guilty, like he was going
to
yell at
it,
me. So I kept eye contact with him.
And it's really hard to feel an emotional connection when you're looking at somebody you've met maybe once.
Yeah.
And
or somebody who's reamed you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in some ways, it was kind of a very detached experience. I didn't feel a lot of emotional.
And then, of course, like, okay, now you guys stand over here and... Everyone come by very quietly. Just say goodbye. And so my family's coming by and we're hugging and whispering. People are crying, but shh, you know, you have to be so quiet.
And then it really bugged me that everybody was in white gym socks.
Wearing booties or whatever.
I was like, this is my wedding. Why are we wearing gym socks? And that, I don't know. It's just lots of little things that bothered me.
So do people wear white gym socks in lieu of, like, temple slippers?
Yeah. No. Well, you don't have to wear your full temple clothing when you go to attend a sealing. You can wear just your church clothing, which was I was fine with because church clothing's nice. But because to protect the carpet, and I think that's all it really is.
It is.
Protect the carpet, they have you take off your shoes and put on these, like, white ankle socks. And it just seemed tacky.
Yeah.
It seemed tacky and, again, cheap. My whole wedding felt tacky and cheap. I hated it.
Well, we were kids.
We were poor students. We weren't coming from great affluence. I mean, my parents are pretty well off, but they're not
wealthy. I was 25, you know, and that's older than most Mormons, but still, you know, we're not 30s with our careers and things like that able to afford. And
a
so
beautiful wedding.
That doesn't bother me as much as it bothers her.
I didn't get a wedding. I grew up all, you know, my wedding, and I didn't get a wedding. So, yeah, it bothers me.
Well, I think it's understandable. I was listening to your story, I was thinking, thank goodness I didn't get married in the temple.
I was going
to
say, you never even witnessed one.
No, I've never been through the temple at all.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about getting married civilly is you're paying somebody to perform at your ceremony, so they do what you tell them to do.
Right.
You
know, and
insert their own agenda.
We went to ceilings later, and I was like, all right, what's this guy going to yell at? And they're all like, marriage is bliss, and you guys are beautiful, and this is a wonderful experience. And I'm like, crap. I got shafted.
So how long after your wedding until you started to become disaffected? How long did you have as like a good little Mormon married couple? Couple years?
2 years.
Year and a half? 2 years?
Okay.
Because we got married, it wasn't until towards the end of 2009. So it was about almost 2 years.
Mm-hmm. And how were those 2 years?
They sucked. Because okay. Here we are, you know, of course there's the whole no sex to go sex and dealing with living together and
you know, the usual first year problems you have
if you're a newly married Mormon
and just young. Any newlyweds anyway. I mean, it's not like, especially when you've never lived together or any of that. I mean, so there's all of that adjustment going on, but then you add to it the expectations of a good Mormon couple, mm-hmm. which is to hold callings, attend church,
start spitting out kids.
Have prayer.
Never did that.
No, we didn't do that. We actually were both like, that feels weird.
Yeah.
Let's not. But having family prayer, we were supposed to have family home evening already.
We did have a picture of Jesus at the head of our bed.
Yeah. I mean, things like that.
You know, he's supposed to be included
in our marriage. It's like mm-hmm. a three-way. Mm-hmm. It's creepy.
Ew. But added to all that, Jessica's health started declining.
Yeah. Turns out, and these are actually kind of common illnesses, and that's why it was kind of frustrating that it took 2 years for the doctors to figure out what was going on. Mm-hmm. But I have irritable bowel syndrome, which we've already mentioned, and endometriosis. Mm-hmm. With endometriosis, I also have menorrhagia, which is basically constant bleeding and cramping. And so it's lots of really fun stuff, very painful. I'd never experienced, you know, debilitating illness before, and I had no coping skills mm-hmm. for it. Mm-hmm. And so emotionally, I would kind of shut down, and I couldn't hold a job because, one, I was in terrible pain all the time, but also I didn't have any skills to know how to work through that mm-hmm. and to go to work anyway. Mm-hmm. I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I was a little girl, and I stayed home from school and had my mommy.
Right.
I didn't know how to handle this. And so I went through about 5 or 6 jobs. And so financially, I wasn't contributing. Aaron felt very burdened, mm-hmm. not just because he was the only one working, but because we were getting medical bills.
She was in the hospital for 2 weeks. And they said that she had an STD, which is weird because we'd only been with each other. Right. And we told him that, but I'm pretty sure he thought we were lying. And so he treated her for it.
A secondary infection. So I had to be ambulanced to LDS hospital. And that was just my first hospital experience. I had surgery. Mm-hmm. They took out my appendix. They weren't sure if anything was going wrong with it. They just wanted something was in my abdomen was a problem. Mm-hmm. And that's like kind of their first... Mm-hmm. You know, so a year later, I'm back in the hospital for another week.
Blessings.
Yeah, well, I'm getting to that. They do surgery and they take out my gallbladder. Again, kind of mm-hmm. Something's going wrong with your abdomen. And during all this time, we're praying, we're fasting, we're in the temple, we're having our names in the temple. We're not really going to the temple because I am sick. Mm-hmm. we're having blessings after blessing after blessing, and nothing's working. Mm-hmm. Nothing. And we're not getting any support or help from our ward. It's almost like we don't exist to them. And it's partly the nature of that ward. We're in an area that's very transitory. It's a lot of mm-hmm. students. They're not going to be there very long. Why make mm-hmm. relationships? You're moving in like a year. Mm-hmm. So it's part of that. And it's partly, I think, just the bishop, he didn't care. So we felt very abandoned by not just our ward, but by God. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We felt like we were being kicked to the curb, and we started beating ourselves up, wondering what we'd done wrong. And we both kind of went into the deep depression.
Yeah, it was really hard.
I was put on antidepressants. Aaron was put back on antidepressants. And our marriage was souring because we were blaming each other and ourselves for everything that was going wrong.
And mm-hmm. part of me wondered if I was getting punished for staying home. And I honestly thought, I was like, maybe I should have gone back.
Maybe I should have gone back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And during this time, we still paid tithing, and Jessica wasn't working, and the only way we survived sometimes is because my mom, every 2 weeks or so, she'd give us a $75 check, which I then turned around and gave as tithing. You know, I'm just like, it was so
our
difficult.
Families were helping us financially
and it was awesome, and they've been so good to help us
through
that.
They have been. They've been very patient with me and my illness and my getting to the point where I know how to function through it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And through all this time, I wanted to do everything I could to make myself worthy to get blessings from God.
Because we weren't getting it.
Yeah, it didn't seem like heaven was there. And
everything
so,
was going to hell in a handbasket.
And I now equate it to when I'm with my dog, and he's got like 7 tricks he can do really well. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he gets really excited because he sees I have a treat. And I'll be like, you know, shake or something, and he'll sit. I'm like, no, no, no. And so he gets so frustrated, he just does all
everything.
The tricks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I felt with God. I was like, okay, tithing, scriptures, go to church, read my, all these things, just trying to get God to be like, oh, that's what you needed to do.
He downloaded, here's your treat. He downloaded the scriptures and as much conference as he could get his hands on onto his iPod, and he used to listen to them while he worked.
Yeah, because the store was closed. I worked on the overnight crew, and mm-hmm. my friends are listening to rock and roll and stuff, and I'm listening to general conference and the scriptures, and I'm checking out library books, Hugh Nibley. I'm reading a little of the Journal of Discourses and just little things like that, participating online, trying to defend the church.
More and more apologetic activity.
Mm-hmm.
Were you thinking that might be like missionary work?
Yeah, I really, again, wanted to defend the church and maybe serve my mission at home.
Okay.
And it was really hard because I thought I was doing everything I could, but there's always something else you can do in Mormonism. There's always something you can improve on.
Yeah, you're never good enough within. And it's not, they'll tell you straight up, no, you're never going to really be good enough, but Jesus will make up for
the
that.
Difference, yeah.
He'll make up the difference. But the thing is that's different than being never good enough within the church.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're never good enough within the church. I mean, and I felt like I was, for me, it was, I'm not a good enough housewife. Again, I can't sew, you know, I hate Relief Society. I always did. Mm-hmm. I never liked Relief Society. I felt like it was very trite. And staged.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt like Relief Society was genuine. And I felt like, you know, oh, we missed family home evening, black mark, you know, mm-hmm. not going to get a blessing now. That I'm not going to get better.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we forgot family prayer. I'm not going to get better. Like, it was just, you could never do it all. I mean, there literally aren't enough physical hours in the day to do everything that you're expected of within the church.
Right, especially if you're in the frame of mind that you just have to figure out whatever trick you need to do to get the
right.
blessing.
Yeah.
I wanted that bone.
So did you get better before you guys started to become
no.
disaffected? That all happened within the same
at
the
least
same time?
They pinned it down, finally, after 2 years.
They diagnosed it. We found the right
half
doctor.
Half of her organs, and then this doctor like talks to her for 5 minutes, like, oh, that's endometriosis.
We finally found the right specialist who was like, this is endometriosis.
I was like, really?
And I was like, that's common. And she's like, yeah, and the doctor should figure that out. She was actually kind of angry on my behalf, which made me happy. Mm-hmm. She did enough third surgery and confirmed it and got rid of some of that scar tissue. And for the first time in like 2.5 years, I was feeling so much better physically. But I did not give the credit to God at that point. Mm-hmm. It was her. She figured it out because she's a learned doctor and an OBGYN. And at that point I didn't really feel like I was mad at God. I felt like I was mad at me, but I guess you could say that God had lost my trust because I felt very abandoned.
So the church has a story. I can't think of the right word that it tells its members that you're going to go through trials and God is testing your faith. Mm. But eventually you'll get over that hurdle and you'll see the benefit of it on the other side. Mm-hmm. So according to the church, the appropriate response to your situation would be immediate gratitude that you had the answer and giving the credit to God and seeing it as
the
end of your
that.
Trial.
Yeah. I guess one of the reasons I didn't do that is because I wasn't healed.
Yeah.
Some of my pain had been relieved, but I have to have surgery every 2 to 3 years now. This is a chronic illness. It's not going away.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to be in pain and am in pain every single day of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just kind of a, basically, you have to learn how to live despite that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not going to be a healing. It's not going away. There is not going to be an answer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because, so even though I was better than I had been, it was still there. It was not, it's something that doesn't stop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there was no miracle. There was no
end of trial.
Yeah. It's okay. Still going on. It's still going on now.
And that's okay. Fine. I mean.
Yeah. And now we've learned how to work with that and learn through and work mm-hmm. through it and learn how to live anyway.
But mm-hmm. the reason it's important in our story is because, like I was saying, I wanted to know everything. I wanted to be so studious in the gospel that I could defend it. And I wanted to be worthy of the blessings. And as many ex-Mormons will tell you, once you start studying the church, bad things get, well.
It falls apart.
Yes. And so that's why it's very important to include.
Yeah.
The illness, because mm-hmm. it started me on the
research
journey.
So it wasn't so much like the cause of us leaving the church, but it's what started him studying.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the studying that got us out.
Right. I'd be in the LDS history section, and I remember one book. I was like, oh, the Mormon and the Negro or something like that. This will be interesting to read. And of course, it was written in like 67 or something before. And they were just like, the Negro will never have the priesthood. And I just remember reading that just thinking, how could they be so wrong?
Well, and outside of that, the things that they were saying about African Americans
was disgusting.
Was very offensive.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so racist.
That it's a blessing to not give African Americans the priesthood because it would be a curse upon them, kind of the way it's better to not know the gospel than know the gospel and sin against, like,
which
that kind of stuff.
Which is incredibly condescending.
Yeah.
It's like a little pat on the head. Mm-hmm. You're not able to handle it, you mm-hmm. sweet little black person.
Mm-hmm.
It just, like, sticks in the back of your throat, you know?
Yeah, I remember, because I still believed, but I read that, and I was just like, ooh, swing and a miss.
Speaking as a man.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so you started learning things that...
Yeah, I wanted to know, because I knew about the Mason and endowment mm-hmm. connection, and I wanted to know more, but the church won't write anything about the endowment, and so sometimes you have to go to, like,
post-Mormon
sites and things like that, and I just didn't really find anything bad. I think I read the Nauvoo Endowment Charter or whatever, where they kept track of who'd been endowed, and they told stories of people peeking through the veil at the other people in the ceremonies and having dances in the celestial room afterwards, and I just remember reading that, and I was like, wow, church was a lot more fun back then.
It was,
except
wasn't
for the
it?
Blood atonement thing, but we'll skip that.
Okay, so did you start to lose your faith at some point?
You know, it's just because I did. I started losing it. I remember talking to my brother about, because I hadn't read No Man Knows My History. I knew that was like the anti-Mormon book. I'd read Rough Stone mm-hmm. Rolling. But
which has quite a lot in it that can shake up mm-hmm. your faith.
But I just remember when he talked about the seer stone in the hat, I was like, well, he got that wrong,
mm-hmm.
you know, and and things like that. And so I remember talking to my brother, say, hey, because he had Nibley books.
What? You might want to specify, not the younger brother that we've talked a lot about.
Just
this
one
is
of my older.
An older brother that we tend to look up to.
I said, hey, have you read his, I think it was Nibley, correct me if I'm wrong, they wrote No Man, That's Not,
not
History.
Yes.
And I was like, wasn't that a great book? It was just so funny. He's like, no, I think it was dumb. I was like, why? He's like, because you don't have to apologize for a prophet. And I just remember sitting there thinking, it just echoed in my brain. And then I was like, well, but there's some things, look at me. And
racism.
And so I just kept learning and studying more. And I finally read No Man Knows My History. And I was like, that's what's talked about in Rough Stone Rolling. Why is this book so evil? And it just went downhill, and I tried to find answers, and they just weren't good enough. Sorry, guys. You know, you can't say horses existed because they have this little toy that looks like a horse. I mean,
in that case, people are going to think that unicorns and dragons and all of that existed.
When they dig up ours.
When anthropologists of the future dig up our toys, they're going to think that Transformers existed.
And it broke my heart. It was very painful.
Well, I think
painful.
It usually does.
Oh, it hurts, yeah.
It hurt, and we were trying to have a baby, and I was taking heavy doses of hormones, and so my mood was everywhere, and I remember being so distraught, thinking, okay, if I commit suicide, I can know if Joseph Smith is there, because I still believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, if I commit suicide, I'll see that it's all true, or it won't be, and then I can finally know. And it was very, very dark and scary time, and it was really hard. And so for people to be like, you're so miserable when you leave the church, it's because people are. They have to go through this whole rebuilding of their entire universe, and it was very painful. Mm-hmm. And I went through it alone because Jessica didn't, she wouldn't.
Yeah, and
believe.
I couldn't, here he is nearly suicidal, and I couldn't be there for him very well because I still believed. And what he was trying to share with me was very scary. Most of it I just dismissed. I didn't listen. I remember one of the very first things he shared with me were the changes to the temple ceremony, mm-hmm. which really bothered me because I had been raised to believe that not only was God extremely consistent, but so was the church. Same,
yesterday.
Yeah, mm-hmm. same as today and yesterday and onward, right? Mm-hmm. So that there were changes to the temple ceremony itself seemed very sacrilegious to me. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, that's just anti-Mormon garbage lies. That's
that there was a preacher and
yeah.
And hurt because I was like, honey, look at this. And she just dismissed
well,
it,
I would
which
dismiss
is what
it.
She's supposed to do.
Yeah.
But then it made me feel invalidated. And I was like, ugh.
Well, and especially since he knew these weren't lies, he wasn't reading, he was reading very well-researched mm-hmm. history, you know, this, and most of which wasn't from anti-Mormon sources
history
at all,
church,
but which was
journal
from
of discourses.
Journal of mm-hmm. Discourses, everything, things that were being sold in Deseret Book and endorsed by the church. Mm-hmm. And so, but then, and I wouldn't listen because it was very scary and very threatening to everything I had been raised in from the
right.
time I was a little thing. So
I'd get mad when she wouldn't, I would just.
And
like,
we'd get in fights. So it's like our marriage had already been getting smacked around, and now it was getting really smacked around.
And the temple and the church was so fundamental in our whole relationship. It's how we met. It was mm-hmm. like, is that our relationship, the church and the temple? Because what happens if we take that away? What's going to happen?
Yeah. I remember very distinctly sitting on our couch. And I can even remember the feel of the cat scratches, like because you know they tear mm-hmm. up our couch. And I remember, and he wasn't home. I think he was at work or something. And at this point, he had communicated to me that his faith was just about kaput. Mm-hmm. And so I was facing the whole being the church widow, mm-hmm. where you're going to church by yourself, raising your kids in the church by yourself. And I was like, well, for my own sanity, I was thinking I would just start attending the ward where my parents were in so that I could have some support. But other than that, I remember thinking, what does this mean to our relationship? What does this mean to our marriage? Did I marry Aaron or did I marry the priesthood holder? Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me that through all that we had been through together, I married Aaron. Mm-hmm. I was in love with Aaron, not the priesthood holder. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, it was kind of a turning point for me, at least, because I recognized that I was, at least, was going to stay committed to him, whether he was an active Mormon or not, mm-hmm. because I was in love with him. And so that was, and because I made that decision, I recognized that I needed to support him. And maybe not take seriously what he was trying to tell me about what he was learning, but at least to listen.
And not make it a fight.
Not make it a fight. And try to just listen I kind of did the whole try to maybe separate myself from it and let it wash over me and not really internalize it. Mm-hmm. That doesn't really
kinda
work.
Like the temple.
It doesn't work.
So up until that point when you made that decision, what was going through your head as far as what he was doing? Did you think he was sinning?
Oh, no, I knew he wasn't. I knew he wasn't.
So you just thought he was dabbling in anti-Mormonism?
Yeah, I thought he was being led astray by Satan, but not, he wasn't doing anything wrong. Mm-hmm. I knew he wasn't having an orgy. I knew he wasn't cheating on me. I knew he wasn't looking at pornography. I knew that he wasn't doing anything wrong.
Okay.
Other than looking at anti-Mormon material.
I did make the mistake of bringing home the Godmakers book mm-hmm. just for the lulls. I knew it was over the top. And I wanted to read it. And I would just start reading it and just start laughing because I knew it was so sensational. Mm-hmm. But so she assumed that. She was like, don't believe that book. You know, and she kind of grouped everything else I was reading into that mm-hmm. category.
Okay. I felt better when I recognized that he could recognize that it was a badly
so
researched
bad.
And biased book. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, okay. But I did lump everything that he was researching, even like Rough Stone Rolling written by an active LDS person under anti-Mormon, because that was the safe place to put it.
I'm very lucky, like, because I've read online. During that time, I was reading online of marriages that had just crumbled because mm-hmm. of doubting and... Mm-hmm. I got lucky.
Okay, so you made that decision that you were going to support Erin and
start listening.
Start listening.
Whoops.
And how did that
It did not take long at all. For me, I'm an English major at Utah State, mm-hmm. and one thing they will just slam into your head is the importance of sources. Mm-hmm. Look at the sources. Where are these people getting their research from? Mm-hmm. And when it comes to history, especially, because I was also a history student, it needs to be primary or, at the worst, secondary mm-hmm. sources. Mm-hmm. Like third and fourth accounts are to be pretty much discredited, right? Mm-hmm. So I start to grab his books from him and go back to the works cited. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, let's see, journals, court records. These are primary mm-hmm. historical sources. Mm-hmm. You can't, as an honest academic student, dismiss those. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, so maybe some of the authors of these books know what they're doing.
She made baby mm-hmm. steps.
I did. I made baby steps. So one of the very first cracks was, again, the changes in the temple. Mm-hmm. Because he showed me that what he was learning and what he was reading, again, primary mm-hmm. sources. Okay, well, maybe, you know. And so I start to do the mental hurdles, right? Mm-hmm. The next crack, I think, was polygamy. Not so much that there had been polygamy, but that Joseph Smith had practiced polygamy very deceitfully, lying to his own wives, lying to his membership, yeah. lying to the world. And that really bothered me. The deception, the lengths of to which he went to deceive, that really bothered me. I'm like, wow, he's a very good liar. This is a problem. And the fact that he married not just women that, you know, because the church is like, these are women that needed protection right. and support. Well, some of these women were married. Mm-hmm. Most of them had parents mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because they were girls, teenage mm-hmm. girls. That's...
And he was coercive about it.
Yeah. And he was very coercive. He was telling, you know, he's telling people that they needed to allow their daughters or their wives to marry him in order to make it to the celestial kingdom. And he mm-hmm. was holding eternity over these people's heads mm-hmm. and sometimes doing it behind men's backs, sending them on missions, marrying their wives. Yeah. And yeah. again, I look at the sources. Some of the sources were things like Lucy Mack Smith, mm-hmm. Emma Smith.
Yeah, the first book I ever saw her actively reading was when I brought home In Sacred Loneliness. Mm-hmm. And that's when she would get...
Tore my heart
that
out.
Was... Mm-hmm. One of the that's when I noticed a huge difference between her just being like, well, the church is kind, it, you know, we don't know everything, whatever, to holy crap,
this is very wrong. This is very wrong. These women are being abused. Mm-hmm. And that really, really bothered me. And from there, it was kind of just a quick, you know, I start to do what he kind of did. You get into that, I need to know more. And you start to read and you start to research. And I read Grant Palmer's An Insider's View of Mormon Origins. Mm-hmm. That was it.
Same here.
Church wasn't true. We're done.
So up until that point, when you were going through all your doubts and she was resisting, you guys were going to church, I assume.
She would.
Sporadically. Okay. And even I was going sporadically. But it was easy for me to go sporadically because most of the time when I get up in the morning, I'm in a lot of pain.
Yeah.
I don't feel well.
And mm-hmm. at that time, I was still working the night crew. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to switch, you know, from going staying awake all night to sleeping all day to, oh, I got to go to church.
Early in the morning.
I didn't like the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. We were going to a student ward.
It just worked out that you didn't have to face going while
no.
doubting. And all
yeah.
that
no,
stuff.
We really didn't. And even the bishop, he could accept you don't feel well and you have a very difficult schedule. I can understand why you wouldn't be here every week, right? Mm-hmm. So we didn't actually have to face the cultural mm-hmm. part of it right at first, which I'm glad. Mm-hmm. I think it gave us the time we needed and the space we needed to work some things out.
Okay, so you came to a point, you read whose book?
Grant Palmer.
I had Todd Compton.
An Insider's View of Mormon
Origins. That was after.
Origins.
That was yeah. after
yeah, but
In
that
Sacred
was,
Loneliness.
That was after In Sacred Loneliness, and that was the icing on the cake. Erin actually was laughing at me.
Because I'd already read it.
He'd already mm-hmm. read it, and he's watching me read it, and I'm marking it like I do my scriptures.
I could hear her in the other room going, ooh!
And I was full-blown just... angry because mm-hmm. I'd been deceived
and
I'd been brainwashed and that mm-hmm. it made me so upset mm-hmm. and again it hurts it hurts because it was everything. It was your childhood, your social network, it's your family, and our families are extended families mm-hmm. we're pioneer stock mm-hmm. so we're talking a very, very devout network around us. And so that was also, that's, and still remains very scary to leave the church in the face of all of them that we love so much and that love us. So, and we can talk more about that later, but.
So how did you tease apart all of the value you had put on your meeting and courtship and wedding? Did you guys, I'm assuming you had to come to peace with all that because you don't want to have hard feelings about that. How did you deal with that part of it?
I think a lot of it, some of it helped that we found out that we had similar feelings about the whole experience. Because, you know, within Mormonism, face value and surface means a lot, right? So if you're dissatisfied with church, you don't actually say so, and you continue to pretend like you're liking it. And you pretend like your family's perfect, at least on the outside. Everyone knows nobody is, but that's the facade that you maintain. So we hadn't really communicated to each other how frustrated we had been with our actual wedding. And so when I think that actually kind of helped when we finally sat down and said, I didn't like our wedding, and I didn't either. Like, oh my God. And I think that helped us to kind of laugh about all of it and about us meeting in the temple. And we kind of laugh now because we know if we talk to a true believing Mormon about how we met, they're going to just be in raptures, and we're just like, wow.
And if they know our disaffection, they're like,
how did that
happen?
What did you do?
That's the kind of story reserved for a future prophet.
Exactly.
Right?
So as a Mormon, we're like, we love telling people how we met. We kind of do this little giggle like, oh,
we're laughing at them the whole time. It's bad. We shouldn't do that.
And then now when they ask us, we usually just look at each other like, should we give them the condensed version or the whole version?
And we're just like, oh, facepalm.
It's like we met at church sometimes is what we say.
So you guys have resigned.
We have.
Why did you decide to resign?
Aaron wanted to a long time before I agreed to do it. And my reservations weren't... We were living with my folks because, again, we were trying to have a baby, right? And
right smack dab in the middle of our disaffection. We moved in. And
my father would have been our bishop and was our bishop, technically. Yeah. And I resisted resigning for the sole reason that I knew my father was going to be the one that had to process the paperwork. Yeah. And I just was not going to do that to him.
Yeah, this was,
and I'm still glad we didn't do that.
This was late 2010. And, yeah, I will be forever grateful for them for opening their house. And and we complain about how hard it was living with Mormons. It was hard on them, too. It was both ways. It was difficult for both of
us. They were amazing.
You didn't just put on a smile and go to church. They knew about your disaffection.
We tried to set up some... We kind of talked about it. We knew we needed to set up some boundaries when living with them. And they set up boundaries, too. My father very specifically said, please don't bring any anti-Mormon material into the home.
His definition of anti-Mormon is very...
Anything that's not complimentary.
Different than mine.
So Rough Stone Rolling is anti-Mormon material?
He's read it. I had...
But I think he has a big shelf.
What book was that? I had Quinn's Magic and...
The Magic Worldview.
Yeah, and I left it on the table just thinking and...
Not thinking.
I got in trouble.
Yeah. And we apologized because we did want to respect...
We didn't think it was anyway.
We didn't consider that anti-Mormon material that he did.
So Jessica... was still going to church a little bit. They gave
I wasn't. I did my calling, but I didn't go to church.
Oh.
My father gave me a calling and told me straight up that it was in hopes to reactivating me.
Okay.
And he knows that I'm a singer. He knows I love music. Because he raised me that way, but my family's very musical. And so he made me choir director, and actually enjoyed it. I love music. And I love the hymns, but I didn't actually have to attend church, except for the one once in a while that we would direct the choir, and I literally would leave immediately after, which hurt my mother to no end. But she even asked me, she's like, "Could you just stay till after sacrament meeting at least?"
Because
I guess it embarrassed her.
Well, yeah, because everyone's like, "Oh, look at the bishop's daughter just
taking off." And I was like, "You're right. That is embarrassing. I'll stay with you."
We didn't do it on purpose, and that's the thing is. When you're disaffecting, you just do normal things that hurt
other
your
people.
Family, and it's horrible.
It is horrible, because I adore my parents, and I adore Aaron's parents, and I would never, ever do anything to hurt them, only I have to think about us, too. I can't mm-hmm. hurt me not to hurt them. Mm-hmm. And for my own health and well-being, I needed to leave. And so it hurt them. And it was hard on them. It was hard on us.
Yeah.
So when it came to resigning...
Did you tell your families? How do they react? That kind
they
of
don't
stuff.
Know.
Or no, I mean about your disaffection.
My family found out is because, you know, I was pissed and hurt and just trying to...
Process
this. So I'd get on Facebook and be like, did you guys know this about Joseph mm-hmm. Smith? And just hellfire and brimstone would break loose. And it was just bad because I was just like, no, this happened.
And unfortunately, in the process, we may have destroyed your very close relationship with our nephew.
Yeah, it's just because...
He put up barriers to protect himself.
I was trying to tell that it's not important what you wear to church. And my niece got on and was like, yes, it is. Yes, it is. I was like, no, it's not. And she started crying and told her mom, which is my sister. And then her sister my sister emailed me and called me a servant of Satan and all these things.
Yeah. And she's been the most vocal and hurt, I think, by Aaron leaving. But I think some of that has to do with the fact that she actually assisted in raising Aaron.
Yeah. And I didn't handle it well, the whole thing. I was really angry.
So I think she hurt,
I lashed
hurt
out
her
a lot
mm-hmm. because she helped to raise him. And so mm-hmm. she felt, I think she might even feel somewhat responsible. I don't know.
Love you, Gina. If you ever listen to this.
She doesn't communicate very well with us ever since us leaving the church. She's also, again, that whole family has, they were raised side by side and they were the closest family we were the closest to, and they've all pulled back. Mm-hmm. They've put up barriers to protect themselves, and I recognize that's what they're doing, but it hurts
sucks.
Them and it hurts us.
So, but you had a brother that was older and left the church.
I don't know if it's because he left the church or what, but he's not very close to us at all. I see him maybe 2 times a year. And
if that.
As being kind of out of the church now, I can kind of relate how awkward it can be sometimes at family gatherings, but I don't know him at all.
Is he close with your family, though?
No.
Okay.
It's that way with all everybody.
And again, I don't know if it's because he left the church, if it's his choice, or... I don't know what the whole history.
There could be family backstory.
Yeah, I don't know because I wasn't even born.
So you would think that if there's already one kid that's gone through it, that like you were raised more gently because your parents figured out, he didn't kill him, break his neck when the other kids did that,
right.
So he'll be fine. But that didn't happen with your disaffection. So, however, he was treated is kind of how you're treated too.
I think it was because I rebelled in my early 20s, you know, and I came back. And they're like, oh, okay, shoot. You know, he made it through that mm-hmm. stage. And
then
so
he did it again.
He did it again. I think it just came out of nowhere because, you know, he never went through the temple and things like that. So it's more severe for me, I guess.
Well, and I have to also remember that his disaffection, and even mine, was very fast.
Mm-hmm.
So from one minute, they knew that he was being a spiritual giant and that he was doing because he even said mm-hmm. so, he was doing everything he could to get the blessings mm-hmm. that we so desperately needed. And he was studying and knew as much about it more than the church than most of them did. And then all of a sudden he didn't believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that scared them.
Yeah. Facebook is how my side found out.
Yeah, because he...
Your side found out when I wasn't able to go into a temple wedding because mm-hmm. my recommend expired. And when I tried to renew it, I wasn't able to get it.
Because he couldn't honestly say he had a testimony.
Right.
Yeah. Whereas me, I was still kind of mostly believing at that point
and was
able to get it. Yeah.
Yeah, and she's, you know, I'm the priesthood holder, so if we don't pay tithing, it's my
fault.
And
right.
So she,
and it also helped that I didn't have a job at that point again, so I was like, it's not my money.
So she got it and was able to go, and I had to sit outside
and
big
watch
red
the
flag
babies.
Right there. Why isn't he going, you know, mm-hmm. he must be addicted to porn.
Oh, I'm so, the thing is because I was raised in the church and especially raised with my family, I know what they're saying behind mm-hmm. our backs mm-hmm. because they said it behind a couple of cousins' backs that have left mm-hmm. the church, and I was there for those conversations. And I know what they're thinking because I was raised to think that way. So I know they're thinking he's doing pornography. I wouldn't be surprised if everyone assumes we'll eventually divorce. Because
of course, because those things happen when you leave the church.
Yes.
Right, yeah.
Hard things befall you as a believer, they're a challenge. Hard things befall you as a non-believer, it's a punishment.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Heather gets it. Star.
So sometimes when we say there's the elephant in the room, it's because mm-hmm. having been there, we know what they're thinking. We mm-hmm. know what they're saying mm-hmm. when we leave.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like when missionaries or someone comes to love bomb you and you're like the guy on Singles Wars. Mm-hmm. He's like, I know their plans, you know.
I know their tactics. Yeah. I've been there. Mm-hmm. And it's that way. So whereas his family found out through Facebook, and most of them handled it really well. We had a very frank discussion with his mother, and even though she expressed great sorrow and regret, she also expressed great love. Mm-hmm. And basically has continued to take us to her heart and love us unconditionally. I've never met anyone able to do that to the extent that she does. Mm-hmm. She's amazing.
If we're around and she says a prayer for the food, it's like two sentences, if that.
Mm-hmm. Because she's trying to be sensitive to our needs, which is amazing. This is her home.
Right, and the what normally happens in those situations is you get called on to say the blessing.
Yeah, and my dad tried it once, and I told him not to.
Well, you told him not to, and later on your mom took him to task.
Really?
She told me that.
Oh.
Your father's just kind of in a lovely state of denial.
And he's just like, whatever.
It's adorable.
Retired. He doesn't care.
Yeah, and you know, he's just enjoying retirement, and the fact is that, again, they've done this, right? Mm-hmm. They have the apostate son who's still out of the church. Their eldest actually left and rebelled for quite some time as well. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of know what to do. Mm-hmm. My family has never experienced this before. Mm-hmm. Like I said, aside from a couple of cousins that we weren't very close to and didn't know very well, this hasn't ever happened.
In the whole family.
And mm-hmm. and they blamed me.
Oh, they blamed Aaron. Well, his family blamed him, too.
Yeah.
He's the priesthood holder, right? I'm the sheep following along
nicely.
For
the longest time, my mom would say to Jessica, you still go to church, right? Just because he doesn't want to doesn't mean you don't have to, you know?
She's like, how are you holding up with him leaving? Mm-hmm. Like, she would come up to me with all the goodwill in the world, and I would have to remind her, mm-hmm. I've left too.
Not left, we just don't go.
We just don't go. I don't go to church anymore either. I don't believe anymore either. Yeah. And so, I try to be so gentle, but...
And, you know, maybe it was my fault that I showed her these things, but I was trying to learn... I was showing her what I learned, and she made the choice herself.
Yeah. So it is true that he's the one that exposed mm-hmm. me to it, but he didn't make my choices for me.
I don't know if men would be treated the same way if it's the woman who left first, but it seems to me that when the man leaves first and the woman follows, there's this really misogynistic, horrible story that gets placed on that about what... Well, you obviously have no brain to make decisions for yourself. Or you don't think for yourself.
I'm just trying to protect our marriage and doing mm-hmm. what a good wife should do. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for a few months or so, we tried, we went on NOM a lot. Mm-hmm. And so we were thinking about doing the middle way, but no, it just wouldn't work.
It's not healthy.
We're not vocal.
Not for us,
I'm
anyway.
Too vocal to just sit back and be like,
he is too vocal.
Those church members, they're trying their best, but, mm-hmm. you know.
Aaron is one of these delightful people, and I absolutely adore this about him, mm-hmm. But that are not afraid to stir the pot. He'll bring mm-hmm. up the controversy and watch mm-hmm. how everybody reacts. He's been termed as one of our dear friends as, with a huge chuckle, as one of the most godless people he knows, just because he's not afraid to stand up and say...
Second most,
because the first was our good friend Shane. Hi, Shane. He's another one of these that was not afraid to bring it all up.
Okay.
And so we recognize that with his courage and just, you sit in church and grind your teeth, you know, and we're just like, this isn't going to be healthy
Especially
for us.
You have IBS.
Yeah, that can give you some pretty bad health repercussions if mm-hmm. you're subjecting yourself to that level of stress. Yeah. We recognized that trying to go through fertility treatments was not only souring our sex life, of course, but putting a lot of stress on us and even making us mad at each other. And we were like, we've done this already just recently. Let's not get mad at each other again so fast. Mm-hmm. and we also, as we left the church, recognized that we all of a sudden, for the first time, had a choice whether or not to procreate. Mm-hmm. Which before that had never been a choice. You get married, you have babies.
Right.
And we were like, wait a minute, do we want kids? Mm-hmm. And we had never even thought to ask ourselves that.
We're so lucky we are going through this now instead of when we have like four kids or three kids.
I know that no parent out there would actually say, I wish we hadn't had kids. But on the other hand, they're probably saying, I wish we hadn't had kids. Or at least I wish we had made the conscious choice ourselves instead of...
Yeah.
going along with the life plan set for us. And and so we feel very thankful for that. And so we stepped back and said, do we even want kids? Let's explore this and let's stop doing fertility treatments. So all of a sudden we now have that extra income that we're not draining on tons of treatments.
And so you're having beer binges.
Of course.
Right? Of course.
Snorting cocaine off hookers' butts.
Ew. So we get our own apartment again, and we feel at liberty, now that my father's not our bishop, to consider resigning. I think we have a few different reasons and a few similar ones. Mine were, I don't want to be I don't want my name associated with an organization that won't release its finances, will build a mall that costs more than all of the humanitarian aid it's ever given. I don't want my name associated with a church that treats gays so poorly and transsexuals so poorly. I don't want to be associated with a church that continues to be racist and sexist. Period. I will not have my name on its records. Okay. That's a corrupt organization that I do not want to be involved with.
Okay.
So,
how about you?
You kept saying we. I said tell your side. I was ready to resign before Jessica, probably the beginning of 2011. I thought about it, and we discussed, you know, we don't want our father or
my father,
her father
to have to do that. That would just break, you know, I would never do that to him.
And one day I rented 127 hours on Blu-ray, you know, the story of the guy.
Yes.
So I'm watching it, and it's to the part where he has to amputate his own arm to free himself. And I had... this is funny because if I was a Mormon, I'd say it was a spirit, but definitely wasn't because I was watching a rated R movie.
Although this is also a Mormonism thing, right? To make everything an analogy. Anyway, go ahead.
Anyway, so shut up. Hearts were filled. Lives were touched. The three thing. Anyway. Okay, so I'm watching him saw his own arm off, and I just had this overwhelming feeling that the rock was Mormonism and my arm was stuck and I needed to live, to be able to flourish. I needed to cut my own arm off, so to speak, to get out. And I remember Jessica came home, or she came into the room later, and I was like, I need to resign. And so I was ready, but we decided to wait.
I said, okay.
And I wanted to resign to show my family that I was serious this time. You know, this wasn't just a, oh, he doesn't want to do things, he wants to drink and party sort of thing. I wanted them to know it was serious. And I didn't want people to think that when I died that I would have polygamist wives and things like that. I wanted to be separate from Mountain Meadows. I didn't want anything like that associated with my name. And when I had friends that are homosexual and lesbian and gay and transgender, I don't want my name associated with an organization that hates them. I know they say they don't, but whatever.
They do.
Actions speak louder than words. And so it was tough because, you know, in the church you're taught, if you don't go to church, your choice could affect generations, you know, thing. And
of course, on the flip side, we're like, yes, let's affect our generations.
Let's affect generations.
Get them out.
I want to be free to think and read what I want. And I just don't want to feel oppressed anymore or associated at all with Mormonism.
Or to be a part of an organization that dictates the very underwear you wear.
Yeah, so we were going to do the mass resignation, but I didn't want to wait any longer. So we sent in via email on April 6th, 2012. So the anniversary of the church being founded. And we sent them in, and within a month, we were totally out. And it was weird because I thought I would feel something, but I didn't.
Not really.
Like, when we first got our confirmation letter, I was kind of shaking, like, oh boy, shit's getting real. But then when we got the letter, I was just like, meh, okay.
I think it's because emotionally we were already gone.
Yeah.
And so we get the letters and we're like, sweet.
And we haven't told anyone in our family, really, except my sister-in-law, who's
on her way out.
I would say she's a liberal, free-thinking woman. And so
she's also a... She does Mormon stories with John DeLynn, or not does Mormon stories. She listens avidly to Mormon
stories
with John
DeLynn. We're trying to convert her to Mormon expression.
We are. We're working on it. But she's taking her time. But yeah, she's on her way out, so we'll help her.
And a lot of people poo-poo on our choices and things like this, but if you knew Jessica then and now, it's amazing how much different she is, how more confident and... how more
laid back, much calmer,
not subtight, not internalizing everything.
I don't have severe anxiety anymore.
Tell them about the doctor.
Yeah,
that treated her throughout this whole thing.
So, I see different doctors for illnesses, right? Because they all have their specialty. So my gastroenterologist, he is non-religious and he doesn't have any real beliefs in a higher power. Not that he communicated with that, about that with me until after I had shared with him. So as he's starting to treat me throughout this whole illness process, those 2 years when they're trying to figure out what's going on, he was far more worried about my mental state than my physical state. Mm-hmm. He knows how to treat IBS. That wasn't the issue. But he was worried because depression and anxiety severely affect IBS. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you've got to get a handle on those because you're going to hurt you're hurting yourself physically. You keep ending up in the hospital. Mm-hmm. I mean, bless the man. He cares about his patients so much and he was very worried about me. So from leaving the church and no longer am I being told I'm not good enough. I no longer have pressures to live up to besides my own and I found a new passion, which for me, it's animal rescue. And I work now at a shelter and I adore it. I love it. I've learned to work through pain and illness and learned how to live and be happy and, just incredibly lightening and freeing. Mm-hmm. And I'm no longer constantly second guessing myself. And so that ball of anxiety and depression that I used to be is considerably gone. It's just gone. It's just gone. Mm-hmm. It's so much lighter. And so I go to, this was kind of recent, just a few months ago. I go to my checkup appointment with him and he comes in and I smile at him and he stopped dead and he said, "You're smiling." Mm-hmm. I know. And I was like, "Yes." And I'm wondering, has he never seen me smile? Goodness. And he said, "What's changed? You seem very happy." And I said, "I am very happy." And I'm thinking, you know, what's changed, right? I'm like, "Oh, I left my religion." And he goes, "I am so glad." He's like, "Religion is just a device of man to control other men."
Yeah, and this is the first time he's ever really mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's, of course, he's never mentioned anything religious to me. And he said, "I don't ever want you to go back." Mm-hmm. And I'm like, "Oh, don't worry."
He's like, I would write you a doctor's note if I could.
And I thought that was hilarious. And I thought it kind of illustrated the change in my own mental and physical state. And I really am so much happier now and so much kinder to people. Mm-hmm. I'm not afraid of the world anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, like, "Oh, my God, that somebody's gay. So, you know, maybe they'll be my friend," and they are.
And, and to hear this, just what Jessica said, and people want to take that away from her or to say that, no, her happiness isn't real.
It's not real. This is all fake. You're being led by the devil.
I call BS on that. And how dare you want to take that away from her?
Right.
And that's what bothers me.
Life is better than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. Ever been.
Mm-hmm. And our marriage is stronger than it's ever been. Because, you know, this life is all we
Jesus
got.
Picture down oh, yeah. off your wall.
We did.
We
replaced it with Carl Sagan, actually. Just kidding.
No.
The flying spaghetti monster.
No, we're actually starting to explore like real art. Mm-hmm. We don't have to stick with Mormon art now. We can actually get other art. Whoa.
Yeah, so we have this life and we don't have eternity. So we have to fix our problems and enjoy each other now because it's what we got.
It's what we got, yeah. And again, like, I found a new passion and a new drive in life, and I found something else that's larger than life that I can be a part of, and that's animal rescue, and that's kind of our future, and is what we're working towards now. And it feels so much more real and tangible, so much more fulfilling, and not constantly beating me down. And so it's not a substitute. It's something that I probably wouldn't have let myself explore, though, if I hadn't left the church. And so it's really made life special.
Yeah, and thanks Mormon Expression for being part of it.
Oh, yeah, the podcasts were a huge help.
All right, well, is there anything that we didn't talk about tonight that you were hoping to cover?
I don't think so.
Nope. All right.
Well, thank you for coming on Mormon Expression Voices, as always. I'm such a copycat. The discussion will continue at mormonexpression.com/voices.
Bye.
Bye.
Loving me for who you think I should be. not sure yet of who I will become. Oh, but I'm feeling brave. I got nothing to lose. I'm so beautiful as I make no excuse. And I move to the edge and I take my gravity. It doesn't matter if I fall, it's time to. I'm feeling beautiful as I make no excuse. And I move to the edge and I take my great leap. It doesn't matter if I fall, 'cause leaps and falls make me a better me.
Directing, producing, and editing was done by Heather C., and the theme music was provided by McCall Erickson. Thank you for listening. Mormon Expression Voices is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Find us on the web at whitefieldseducational.org. The Mormon Expression and Mormon Expression Voices podcasts, as well as other educational initiatives, are made possible by your generous donations. Please consider a subscription today.